Sunday is going down. November 13th, 4 p.m. At the WGXC Studios. A workshop like no other workshop that you've ever heard. A special promotion workshop for all of the programmers, the producers, the team members. Does not matter. Come through. This event hosted by Sarah Kendall with special invited guests at Issue, Hotline Radio, and more. You better be there, especially if you want to learn how you too can become number one. WGXC Studios, Sunday, November 13th at 4 p.m. Be there.
Be there.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Stair Galleries, a full-service auction house specializing in fine art and antiques, offering appraisals, live auctions, online catalogs, and Friday evening exposition auctions featuring antiques and home furnishings. Located at 549 Warren Street in Hudson, New York, and online at stairgalleries.com.
Listening to WGXC 90.7 Acra Hudson Catskill, and this month's edition of The Score, where we feature film and television soundtracks and scores.
I am Margot Pelletier.
And I am Lisa Thomas, and we are your hosts. At the top of the show, you heard the song Dakota Gold from the 2009 award-winning documentary Crude Independence. The song's composer, Noah Hutton, also happens to be the film's director. And today in the studio, we are happy to have Noah. Noah Hutton got his start working behind the camera in 2007 on the set of Shooting for Peace, a documentary filmed in Uganda. Also here in the studio today is WGXC's very own Sarah Kendall, who was the co-producer of Crude Independence. Thank you both for being a part of our show.
Yeah. Thanks for having us here.
I wanted to ask you both, can you describe for our listeners the premise of the film, Crude Independence, and how you both came to make this film and work together?
Sure. So the premise for the film came from reading a New York Times article, which was a front page article on this oil boom in North Dakota. And this was published January 1st, New Year's Day of 2008. And we were both in college at the time. I was home on winter break. And it struck me, the article, not so much for its handling of any sort of environmental impact of the drilling, which I think we have all been aware of, but of the social impact of this oil boom on small towns in the western part of the state. So I was really struck by the image, the picture they chose, which was a large well flaring up with natural gas that they were just burning off because they were just rushing to pump out the gold. The landscape I saw in that picture, coupled with what was in the article, which was a description of motels overflowing with oil workers, businesses booming on Main Street, people, farmers receiving checks every month for mineral royalties that they had never received before, had no idea that there was any oil beneath their property. So I was struck more by what this meant for people who had such a close connection to the land that they lived on their whole lives and may have inherited from their fathers and grandfathers who came from Norway two generations removed. And to live on, to have such a deep connection with the land that you've that's been passed down to you, and to have no idea about this, and then to have your whole community really changed by the arrival of these out-of-state oil workers who are going to come in and sign leases and start drilling.
There was a quote in that article that I remember you picking out that was from a local sheriff that said, like, this is the boom is only going to bring headache and heartache.
That's right. That was such a great quote.
And it just sort of like it spoke so like obviously to a narrative medium for the weight and the complexity of that kind of moment for a small town for a residential community seemed like so palpable.
Absolutely. So I went to do like a initial trip that winter to North Dakota to scout it out.
Actually, Noah and I had this conversation. Noah started talking about this idea he had to make this film. And then the next I heard from him, he was in North Dakota.
that was that winter.
He was like, I flew out here.
And were you guys both film students at the time, or how did you know each other?
No, we've just been friends since, you know, we went to school together.
We went to high school together.
Yeah, high school. And we were both in college, but neither of us were film students. And I had worked on, you mentioned this film in Uganda I'd worked on that previous summer. So I had this sort of boldness where I thought I can direct a film now because I had worked on this film in Africa, and I was like, I'm ready. I can do it.
I'm a filmmaker.
Yeah. And
well, but, you have to have that attitude.
Definitely. You definitely have to be like, I'm a filmmaker.
I went there to sort of confirm what I'd seen in the article, which was, yes, this is an incredible landscape and this is happening. And I came back in the spring, the whole spring, we kind of talked about it. And I raised some money to go make it that summer. So we spent that summer in North Dakota where we did the bulk of the filming.
Wow.
It was the two of us plus my stepbrother. It was just three of us.
And his name is?
His name is Sam Howard. And we all stayed in one motel room together.
Wow.
For the summer.
Okay, we're not going there,
but. Oh, okay. Well,
it's more boring than you think.
Now you're getting the picture. Just to fill it out a little bit. So yes, this film indeed is told from the point of view of several residents of the rural town of Stanley, North Dakota, population 1,300. It's also told from the point of view of the oil workers who have indeed swelled the area in the motels, the restaurants, the library, the bars, and even the jails. In the film, we do witness how their lives have changed dramatically. So Stanley was once the poorest town, or one of the poorest towns in the United States, and now indeed it is the site of one of the largest oil finds in history. In fact, according to the government's Energy Administration in 2010, 225,000 barrels of oil each day were being extracted from the ground in Stanley. And this was happening through the technology that we're hearing an awful lot about in our area upstate, hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. So just so our audiences understand a little bit about that technology, hydraulic fracturing is the process of injecting massive amounts of water, sand, and chemicals deep into the ground at a high pressure to crack the rock beneath, allowing the trapped oil, or in some cases gas, or in some cases both, to flow up through the wellbore. The process is very controversial, and in extracting gas, fracking has been known to contaminate water wells and land. In addition, as in Stanley, North Dakota, the process does indeed change the natural landscape into stretches peppered with giant kind of erector set rigs and fire pits. In the case of Stanley, it has also turned dust into gold. As we mentioned before, Stanley, one of the poorest towns in the U.S., in 2009 had a $1.1 billion surplus. What is happening in Stanley is almost like a story from the Bible or mythology, going from despair to ultra prosperity. But the question that haunted me while watching the film was, are the people of Stanley shaking hands with the devil? In the next hour, we are fortunate enough to have the director, Noah Hutton, and the co-producer, Sarah Kendall, with us. We will be listening to the score that was composed by Noah and speaking about the film, and perhaps we will answer this question.
So we wanted to ask you guys, kind of in your own words, if you could talk a little bit about the oil boom in North Dakota, because I know that they had known that the oil was there since like the 50s, but only recently were they able to kind of use this new technology to get at the oil. And, you know, specifically like how you guys feel that changed the town of Stanley.
Right. So they had wells drilled like back to 1950 in a town called Tioga was the first well, which was a little west of where we were. But it was the difference is the strata of where the oil is, like which rock formation the oil is found in. So the earlier formations were much closer to the surface. Those are the classic ones where we've struck oil and it almost bubbles up, and that's the kind of well they were drilling in a place like Tioga back in the 50s. The difference, what began happening in the late 90s in the oil industry and into the time of this discovery, which was in 2006, was a focus on deeper formations, most of which are the oil is bound up in shale rock. So companies weren't able to drill down and have it be profitable before this horizontal hydraulic fracturing technique was perfected and widely disseminated through the industry. So what happened in 2006 was the United States Geological Survey had started to, you know, they've been testing rocks. You can go to any sort of, like we went to in the eastern part of the state in North Dakota, they have this huge warehouse with rock samples from the whole state. And I think every state has something like this, that the United States Geological Survey does surveys of rock formations anyway. And oil companies will come in and look at what oil composites are in which level of rock, and then they'll decide if we want to drill or not. So I think it was kind of the perfect storm in 2006 was United States Geological Survey had discovered in the Bakken Shale, which is 10,000 feet beneath North Dakota and into Montana and parts of Canada, that it was oil rich. And companies at that point had perfected this, or had really perfected this hydraulic fracturing horizontal drilling technique. So it's all a bottom line thing with that industry. It's like if we can profit from, if one barrel costs less than it does, you know, for us to extract and sell it on the global market, we'll drill. And in North Dakota, that balance really got swung towards the profitability side because they could do this hydraulic fracturing, horizontal drilling. They knew they weren't going to run up against the kind of backlash that they're running into in New York and Pennsylvania because it is a very conservative state, and they could kind of just go in immediately. I think that was a big part of it too.
In a very poor state,
farmers kind of, you know, many farmers struggling with their pre-existing agricultural businesses. So 2006, the discovery is made. I think there was a couple years of exploration, lining up at the courthouse at dawn to sign land records. And then the drilling really got kicked in 2007. 2008, it was just feeling like the boom was rising, which is when the article was written and when we were there.
And to understand a little bit of the landscape of that place, it's big sky country. So unless there are people, there aren't trees. It's incredibly bare, incredibly vast. We were in canola, rapeseed and flax country. So it's huge fields of yellow rapeseed flowers and blue flax. And there's so this incredibly like wide bare landscape, and then also these sort of ghost towns scattered around, where you see towns that no longer exist, and like old homestead structures still intact with like kitchen scenes kind of
so
laid
like
out.
People that left the farm?
Oh, man.
Yeah, towns that, I mean, when with bottomless economies where there's like, you know, 12 residents of a town and they're all above the age of 80 or no one. And also a little bit west of us was the town of Williston that had gone through an oil boom. How many years earlier?
In the 80s, yeah.
In the 80s, and that had been, there had been a huge amount of excitement there, and then the boom rise, and then the bust fall really quickly, and so that was a sort of like post boom landscape with incredibly nearby that was like this sort of like visual reminder of the uncertainty of this, right, of this kind of development. So people were it's not only a conservative state, but people were really like, there really was this sense of like, we don't know what we're getting into. And there were, and Williston was so neat, was this sort of like decaying small urban center so close to Stanley. So in a place like Stanley, for a residential community, figuring out how to sustain, how to stay alive, and also how to not boom bust.
Yeah. So according to a 2010 U.S. Census report, Stanley has a total area of 1.7 square miles, with a population of 1,458 people. So to give our listeners a good sense of the size and population of Stanley, I researched the stats in our two counties and found that the town of Valencia, right here in Columbia County, is the closest in size and population to Stanley. So that gives you a really good sense of the size of the town that we're talking about. So now we're going to play the song Stanley from the film Crude Independence. Just heard the song Stanley, written by composer Noah Hutton, who we are fortunate enough to have here in the studio with us today talking about his film Crude Independence. The ending of that song, Stanley, to me feels slightly reminiscent of the Northern Exposure theme song composed by David Schwartz.
So, Noah, I wanted to know if you can tell us who your influences are musically and what your process was when composing music for the film.
Sure. I think, listening to that, I was remembering, like, when I, in the time I was making that music, what my influences were then, because I think it's changed a lot in the 2 years since I've been making music since then. But then I was really listening a lot to Thomas Newman, who did the score for American Beauty, which was very influential for me. I've always been a big Philip Glass fan, and I think I'm both being a fan of that and also limited by like my own my own theory limits, and like I never got very far in studying music and theory, so that most of how I compose is just by ear, and it's limited by my own dexterity since I'm performing it too. So like you're never gonna hear very like classical flourishes and stuff in my because I can't play it and I do it by ear, and it's not what I. So I make stuff that is very percussive, because I really grew up as a drummer first before I started playing piano, and even when I play keyboard instruments, like there's a lot of marimba in my stuff. It's almost using like melody in a percussive way. It's finding kind of very simple melodies and like putting a few of them around each other, you know, changing octaves, going a fifth up, going sort of around the inverting the rhythm a little bit, and just sort of building songs that have a very simple idea that expand rhythmically around that and then sort of wrap up. That's what that song was to me.
Right. Yeah, it's such a rare trait for a filmmaker to have both the talents to be gifted musically coupled with the resources one needs to be a good filmmaker. Being able to compose one's own work is such a huge asset for a filmmaker, especially in the realm of independent filmmaking, where music rights can often hold up the release of a film. And I kind of know this personally. I worked on a documentary about 10 years ago about the music promoter Sid Bernstein Presents, who brought the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and a lot of folks from the British invasion over to the U.S. And the film has never been released because of all the music rights issues with it. So it really is such a gift that you're able to both compose and you know, film your own work. So,
wow. Thank you.
Also, gaining the trust of one's subject is paramount in documentary making. Given the sensitive nature of the broader subject, that being hydraulic fracturing for oil, Noah and Sarah, can you tell us how you were able to gain the trust of the residents of Stanley and have them open up to you?
Well, we went out there in like in the wake of a kind of a media storm. We were just before we had arrived. A lot of the major news networks had done kind of short pieces about what was going on in Stanley, and people were really, really shaken by the experience they had with big media. So there was one woman we spoke to who had just been interviewed for Fox News, and that story was incredibly irresponsible. It was like, It talked about what was happening, and it said, you know, new millionaires in the town of Stanley, North Dakota. Some neighbors are millionaires, and some are just jealous.
That's
like
right.
That.
They set it up. It was one of these in studio commentators setting it up like that, and then they cut to her giving
jealous.
One line, and you've been primed to think that she's a jealous person.
And then she was saying my home is changing around me, and like this is, I don't feel safe here right now. We're locking our doors for the first time, and so when we got there, there was a huge amount of distrust on the part of a lot of people that we were talking to about people coming in with cameras. We were lucky because we were moving into the town's one motel, which was also. Had a bar attached to it, which was one of the town's only bars, and it was the motel was kind of functioning as like sort of a temporary apartment complex for a lot of the workers coming in, pipeline engineers and rig workers. I think they had changed the towels to black.
That someone says that in the film is that they changed the sheets and towels to black because they were like coming dirty. In too dirty from the rigs, and it was just the laundry that the onus of having to clean the blackened sheets got too extreme that they just changed all of it.
And like Noah said, we were living in this little motel room together, so our living room was sort of this bar that was not only the hangout for all of these oil workers, but also one of the only like local bar hangouts. So it really was kind of a social center, and we spent a lot of time. Because we were making this longer form piece, and 3 months. How long were we there?
Like a little over 2 months.
Over 2 months is an incredibly short amount of time, but compared to these like Fox News anchors coming in and out, we actually did have the time to be real, really patient listeners, and we were so incredibly curious and really wanting to hear, wanting to understand the emotional complexity of what was going on, that I think the sort of just conversation after conversation, people started to, people really do want the chance to talk about what they're going through.
It wasn't so easy in the beginning with Trust. We didn't just walk in and people were pouring themselves out to us. We really worked at it, and it was a little frustrating in the beginning to call people and have them not be so willing to do interviews. And I understood it because of kind of what we were coming on the heels of, and we were from New York, and it wasn't clear to them, are we here to do like an environmental expose film and show how stupid people are here and why are they signing away their land and kind of thing, you know? People were very wary of that.
Like, what are you, some kind of environmentalist?
Yeah, we got that a lot, you know, and we were, no. But we really knew that we weren't making that kind of film. So, one thing I think we did, which is key in my mind, I don't know how key it actually was, but in my mind it's key, is that the first two Saturday nights we were there, we sang karaoke in front of everyone. And we didn't have that many friends then. I feel like we made some of our first friends by kind of making fools of ourselves and being willing to sort of get up there and sing Kenny Chesney and like not feel like we were from New York and too cool to do that, you know?
Yeah.
That I think that was a big deal.
Karaoke was definitely big.
That was the icebreaker.
It also was one of the only times that a lot of the people who weren't from Stanley who had moved there for the because they were somehow working with or connected to the oil industry stuff going on, and then a lot of the local residents. It was one of the only places that people actually crossed paths. So like a rig worker would stand up and sing like Linkin Park.
It's in the film. It's sort of a wild area, that place, because it really was this collision of all the forces of the town, like the workers, people who were gonna come there every Saturday anyway because they've been coming there from before the boom for karaoke, and they weren't gonna stop just because the oil workers, you know. So they would proudly come, and like we had great, one of our best friends, this couple, was a family from Stanley who, you know, lived there their whole lives. And we also got to know oil workers. So we really befriended people on every side of the issue. And no one looked down on us for talking to the other people. We were able to sort of just be curious with everyone. And I think people ended up trusting us because, like Sarah said, we were just around. We were like always there. Whereas these other media people would come and they'd be gone, and then you'd see an article, you'd see something, and you'd be dismayed. We were just there. It was clear we were working on something that was more thoughtful and more, you know, interested in all aspects of the issue than just getting what we needed and getting out kind of thing. So,
well, and also like expressly, like explicitly not interested in the spectacle of what was going on. I think the sort of like, it was so easy to get to hop onto that story of like millionaires in this town, and that wasn't we didn't come with a story in mind, and we were and what unfolded wasn't a really like dramatic narrative. It really was a sort of portrait of a really complicated moment for a place, and I do think it, like, ideally we would have been there for
we would have spent much more time there. The boom only got more intense since I went back there twice since making it, and Like, it was clear that things had just escalated in every aspect. And now it's continually in the news. Like, CNN has just done a huge series of pieces about North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, only booming more and more, especially in the face of the ongoing economic troubles. It's been this weird sort of, opposite variable where it's like on the graph of our nation's economy, somehow North Dakota's like rising.
Yeah.
When, you know, and it's so I think people.
Everybody
have been,
else is in a recession and North Dakota's like doing well because of this oil.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think it is a question I think we were asking a lot and the people that we were talking to were asking a lot about who are the storytellers here? Like, who should tell this story? Who is empowered with representation here, and we were trying so hard to have our ears to the ground and really be this sort of like allow this portrait to sort of speak for itself using the skills that a filmmaker has to tell a really compelling story. But I think for me personally, it's a lot of I think that project is a lot of what sort of informed my work here at the radio station and thinking about participatory media and how to invite more and more people into. Both into the kind of technical spaces of media making, so train people to use the kind of equipment we have here, but then also thinking about like what are the stories we have to tell, and what is your neighborhood going through, what is your family going through, and how do you what are the tools for communication there? I think the question about trust and how we define the encounters between media makers and subjects is such, it's so huge. I'm kind of fascinated by it.
Yeah. We were curious, Sarah, like how, what your responsibilities were as a producer on the film and sort of, I mean, I don't know if you were like behind the scenes also doing filming, or were you kind of more, the go-between in terms of setting up a lot of these interviews, or sort of what were your tasks behind the scenes?
Well, we were such a small team. That we had, I think we had kind of outlined job descriptions. Like Sam, who we were with, did our budget, and was our driver.
Sam spent a lot of time laying on his stomach in our motel room watching SportsCenter
and video chatting
and keeping our Excel spreadsheet in tip top shape. And Sarah and I did a lot of the field work.
So but Sam was counting the receipts every day we've spent. XML.
Yeah, exactly. He was very good at that, though.
He was the line producer.
He was in business
lying
school
on
at
his
the time.
Bed.
Yeah.
But it's actually an interesting question because I sometimes think about what like Noah was our director and we were sort of I think about what kind of piece I would have made if I wasn't on your team, and I'm not sure I ever would have brought the camera out. I really was sensitive to how people perceived the project we were doing and in what way people wanted to participate and so much wanted to build a real foundation of understanding and trust. And cameras make people incredibly uncomfortable, this huge piece of equipment that you wield. And I think I always thought we were pulling the cameras out too early, and I'm not sure I ever would have pulled out the camera and ever would have.
It's kind of the most agonizing thing to do, I will agree. Like, it's not to transition from sitting and talking with someone, which is seems very normal and human, to like taking out this piece of equipment and setting it up and then trying to continue talking with them like as you were before is very unnatural. And it's like that's what I have to say, that was one of the hardest things.
Well, and then Noah had a lot more experience understanding what actually goes into making a film, and could like conversations we were in, I think you were quicker to hear something and say, oh, we really need to get that on camera, like this is, so there was a kind, there was I think a push and pull that was happening there that I think maybe the way I best understand what I my role it really did have to do a lot of like with a lot of this the social end of what we were doing, making friends, I like making those kinds of connections and then building kind of a foundation of comfort and in order to then get into the
we would have never been able to talk to the oil workers that we eventually talked to in the film. We tried so hard to do like the things you usually do, like what the producers normally do: call the oil companies, talk to the representatives, try to get permission from like these executives in Houston or wherever we were getting connected to. None of it was working, and then every time we'd like go up to the workers that we were friends with at the bar, and I'd go up and like earnestly ask, like, so do you think we could. Like, do you think we could sit down and do an interview later? You know, and they're like drinking beers, and I'm like, no, no. And like, you know, not only that, but like they knew they couldn't because they would never have permission from their boss. It would have to be run up the flagpole. So like Sarah managed to like befriend this group of workers to such a degree that they probably all thought they had a chance with her too.
She charmed them.
That was part
them.
Of it too. But like
she charmed them.
She charmed them to such a degree that we were able to like they eventually just went out behind the bar with us while they were drinking and said, okay, let's do it. You know, I ran to the car and got the camera, and Sarah's the one asking the questions in that interview, and I'm just like trying to move the camera around as fast as I can. So
it's great. Let me put another song on here so that we're not talking the whole show here, and we're gonna play a song called "They Started Showing Up," referring to the oil men and all the machinery.
Thank you.
If you are just tuning in, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 in this month's edition of The Score, where we are featuring today the music from the soundtrack Crude Independence and talking with the film's director, composer, Noah Hutton, and the film's co-producer, Sarah Kendall.
In your DVD extras, you said that you did not want to project an agenda in making your film Crude Independence. Now, the byline on the jacket cover reads, "The hopes of a town lie beneath its ground." Now, in my view, that statement does seem to put a positive light on fracking for oil. At the same time, the title, Crude Independence, also for me, the word independence puts a positive spin on the subject. Myself being someone who has watched Gasland and gone to the discussions in our area about hydraulic fracturing for gas, and I am very concerned about the undermining of the dangers of this technology, especially by big business people and politicians, I was a bit shaken to meet the people interviewed in the film, almost all of whom seemed to impart that their lives had changed for the better due to the oil boom. I wanted to ask you both, as filmmakers who have a documentary that reaches many people, how do you feel about the responsibility attached to making a film that does seem to put a positive spin on such a controversial subject?
Well, there's a lot to say towards that. One is that there's no, and I assume when you're talking about the controversy, you're talking all about environmental issues.
Yeah.
Environmental impact. So there's none of that in the film. I mean, there's a little discussion of the roads being torn up and the view changing, but it's left out. So you could, and I mean, the film has been criticized for not taking a stance on that. And it's interesting because as we talked about before, I worked on Gasland. So I've like, and honestly, that's where I am politically on the issue. Like I am of Gasland to approaching this. Like no part of me wants there to be a furthering of gas drilling in this country. Now, where I differ a little bit from Josh Fox, I think, and the makers of Gasland and people who are like hard line on this issue is that I think we're only going to further a cultural warfare, political warfare in this country by telling a farmer who can't put his kids through college, who is approached by a gas company with a lease for thousands of dollars, if we tell that farmer, no, you can't sign that. You can't get thousands of dollars a month and send your kids to college. We need to be able to say, no, don't sign that. Here's something else you can do that is an alternative to that option. Because people have to understand, people have to put themselves in the shoes of someone in North Dakota. And, you know, I'm from New York, so I really feel more strongly about the issue locally here about fracking. I think that it's a bit of a different situation here than it is in North Dakota, especially because it concerns a watershed, the Delaware watershed, that you don't really deal with that in North Dakota in the way you do here. The potential impact of hydraulic fracturing in upstate Pennsylvania and New York is so severe, potentially severe, on the water supply for millions of people that I think it's a bit more pressing here on the environmental side of the issue than it is in North Dakota. Now, back to the farmer for a second. I intentionally made the film the way I did because I was pretty fed up with the way that the 24-hour media cycle deals with this issue of oil drilling. At the time in 2008, this was like it is now still, but it was acute. I mean, in 2008, gas was soaring. The price of gas was soaring. Price of a barrel of oil was at $150, the highest it had been in however long. So this was a big time issue at that moment in American history. people on every median, on every cable news network, most of the articles you read, you know, if it was MSNBC, they'd be talking about how ridiculous the oil industry is and just, you know, we need to move beyond this, and no attention to like what it might be like for a farmer in North Dakota to be faced with this issue. On Fox News, it was the opposite. It was, you know, the Democrats are holding us back from energy independence, and we could really do a lot by just drilling. And in the film, Senator Dorgan says, you know, that's the yesterday forever policy of the Bush administration. You know, and I left that in because I agree with that. You know, it's the drill policy is not at all what I'm saying that the solution is for that state. I just, by going there and sort of talking to the people, I realized that until we can come to a farmer and say, don't do this, do this. Like, no, and then give him a yes. Instead of just saying to this farmer, no, you know, we're not being responsible to the issue. We're being divisive. You know, we're not understanding, we're not having the empathy we need for the position of a farmer in North Dakota who can't put his kids through college without this economic support, either because we haven't handled agricultural, you know, economics properly in this country where farming is profitable enough for this person. That's the issue. Maybe it's like, no, don't sign this because we're going to help you with subsidies for your farming business. Like, there's got to be a yes, but I wasn't hearing it. So I wanted to make a film where by watching it, you can understand what it's like to live in this town and be presented with this issue and not have me saying, but don't you think this could be dangerous? Don't you think? Because I didn't have an alternative. I was a college kid. I mean, like, I'm not a policymaker. I just wanted to let these people in a town in North Dakota tell it like it is for themselves, because I didn't feel like their voice was being heard in any other media outlet. And that's the best answer I can
I do. I do think we do ourselves a huge disservice on anyone. If you are an anti-fracking activist, if you are engaged in the issue and in the conversation in any way, if you don't pause to hear some of the voices on the ground, and that includes people who are employed. Workers who are working within the oil industry. It includes people who live in who are benefiting financially from it. People who are watching their neighbors benefit and not receiving anything. I think it's like to let this sort of chorus of voices to bring that chorus into the conversation, to embrace the nuance of it, and not I think we were. Wary of our own position, sort of framing the entire piece, because we felt legitimately like uneducated about a lot of it. It was sort of like we are more curious than we are experts here. And so to say, like, you tell us what's going on here, emotionally, like that. Our question going out there was not should they be drilling or not in Stanley. It was sort of like, what in the world does it feel like to be here right now?
That's right.
And even if the answers were not what we wanted, we didn't even want to know what we wanted.
You had mentioned, though, that you had gone back a few times since making the film. And I was curious if any of the people that you had interviewed in the film had reversed their positions at all, or really changed their point of view about the oil drilling and the effects on the town.
I felt a little bit of that. I met back up with a couple people we interviewed in the film, and especially, like, for example, the sheriff, who didn't really come on either side. I mean, seemed mostly like everyone else in the film, like you mentioned, okay with it, and like, it could help us, but we got to just make sure that we handle it right. When I went back there, he was stressed. He was stressed out, and it was mostly because that they had set up all these temporary man camps for the workers outside of town. Like, and they just looked like refugee camps. I mean, they were just these lines of single cell living quarters with, you know, where these workers were set up. And he said, there's a lot of drug problems now, there's crime, you know, and he was stressed. And it didn't seem like the positivity, it seemed like he had kind of shed. I wanted to get back to what you brought up for a second about on the jacket cover of the film, it says the hopes of the town lie right beneath its ground. That, to me, is an accurate representation of the summation of the feelings that we found in the town. Like, that's why we put it on. As you felt in the film, it's like most people we interviewed are kind of vaguely hopeful that this could help them, but they're just not sure if it, you know, they want to make sure, like, the bus they've seen in the other town that we mentioned before doesn't happen there. You know, they just want to make sure it's handled right. But generally, like, yeah, this could be good. That's what that was in response to. You know, it wasn't like our editorial.
Right. So we're going to play a song now from the Cronus Quartet called Funeral March. And we'll be back to talk to you in just a minute.
Thank you.
So that was Funeral March by the Kronos Quartet. And Noah, I was just kind of curious, like, what made you choose that song to put in the film?
It's one of these things where you put in some music where you want, or you have a tone you want to hit, and you always assume that you're going to go and compose to replace it later. And I did that for the whole film except for this song. I couldn't make anything that came close to evoking what this song did for me. So I had to leave it in, and we paid for it, you know. But I mean, we pay it, we license it properly and everything. Right. But it's the only song that's not mine that's in the film. It comes at the end.
So one song out of 10 is not too bad to have to pay for, though.
No.
So you have a current film out now called More to Live For, correct?
Yeah, I made it for a cancer foundation.
Yeah, so you want to tell us just briefly, give us a brief synopsis on that. And I know that the Hudson Valley Film Commission is sponsoring some screenings here in the Hudson Valley in like a week or two. So you mm-hmm. want to tell us when those and where those are happening?
I wish I had that in front of me.
I know it's the like December... But tell us
December 8th, 9th, 10th. Yeah.
Yeah, tell us first what the film is about. Yeah.
Okay. It follows three men who all have been diagnosed with leukemia, and they're all looking for a genetic match to save their life by donating bone marrow. So it's a film to raise awareness about how easy it is now to get first signed up. You just get swabbed the inside of your cheek, and then you're on the international registry. And then anyone who has leukemia or 70 other diseases of the immune system or blood, because it all comes, bone marrow generates the stem cells that both makes your blood and your T cells that are in your immune system. Anyone who's on that registry and you match your immune system with can donate their cells to save your life for leukemia. And it used to be that you'd have to like go into surgery and they drill into your hip bone and it was super painful. Now you just give blood, they extract the stem cells through your blood. It's like giving blood. And it's, like, this is just an awareness issue because, you know, thousands of people still die every year from leukemia who can't find a match. And if we just had more people on this registry, more people would find a match and more people would be able to donate. Once you're on the registry, you can keep saving lives if you keep getting matched. It's just something that everyone should do, you know.
Yeah. So I think you can actually catch the film at the Spectrum on December 8th.
You're
right?
Good.
Rosendale on the 9th and somewhere down in Newburgh.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yep. Because I read about it. So, yeah, so we have one more song coming up here, and I know Margo wants to do her
I want to mention quickly that the film is called Crude Independence, not because I'm a proponent of energy independence, but because of the July 4th Independence Day parade.
Oh, that you have in the film.
It's throughout the whole film. Right, so the independence refers to the parade, actually, not to like... But it's maybe there's a little bit of that too, but it's like mostly about the parade. You know what I mean?
I think
such a loaded word.
We struck a nerve there. But you can see the film, like you can get it on DVD.
Yeah, so it's right? You can order on DVD on Amazon. It's also on iTunes, and now it's streaming on Netflix and Hulu.
Yeah, so you can definitely check the film out. I'd highly recommend it. It's a great watch. So,
well, we certainly want to thank our guests Noah Hutton and Sarah Kendall. And want you to know that you've been listening to WGXC Community Radio 90.7. So until next month, be good to yourself, be better to your neighbors, and before you do anything, make sure you know the score.